Welcome to episode 30 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks. I'm a political scientist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. And today I'll be talking with Iñaki Sagarzazu, who is assistant professor of political science at Texas Tech University. He studies political communication, voting, and Venezuelan politics. Iñaki, thanks so much for taking the time to do this.
Thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
And so today we're going to be talking about Venezuelan politics after the Supreme Court revoked the power of the legislature, threatened its members, then it seemed to back off, and we're in this sort of strange limbo of trying to figure out what's going on. But before even getting to that, I have a question that I ask all of the people that that I talk to on the podcast, and that is, what first got you interested in studying Latin American politics?
Well, I am from Venezuela, and I've always been interested in politics. In fact, when I was a kid, I was like, we changed the electoral system in Venezuela from PR to some sort of mixed system, and I was puzzled about the consequences that that had on representation. Okay, and always after that, I sort of was thinking I have to study this. After deviating to study computer engineering in university, I went back to study political science, and of course, as a region of choice, as a Venezuelan, I study Latin American politics and pretty much anything I can on Venezuela.
So, did you bring anything from computer engineering into political science at all? Does anything transfer over?
Yes, actually, it does. I do quantitative text analysis, and so for that, I use a lot of programming.
Okay, cool. So the thing I want to start with Venezuela is just thinking about the terminology, and I wanted to get your opinion on whether it's accurate to call what happened an autogolpe.
Yeah, you could call it an autogolpe. I use the term judicial coup on Twitter, just because it's, I mean, if you consider that the whole, the Chavismo as a whole is a unit, then yes, it's definitely an autogolpe. But if you consider that there's sort of, you have the legislature and, well, the presidency and the Supreme Court, the coup was sponsored by the Supreme Court.
Right.
Which is why I called it a judicial coup. But yeah, I think either or, it's the same thing. The Chavismo threw a coup to get rid of the only one institution that wasn't controlled by them.
And to what degree do you think of it as a judicial coup versus an autogolpe? An autogolpe typically is focused more on the executive. You know, how much is the judicial branch and the executive branch a unit? Or how much have they developed their own particular interest, do you think?
Well, I think their interest is protecting the regime. Not so much protecting Maduro as a person, as the leader. I think they're protecting the regime, and I think that's why they're only getting rid of the uncomfortable opposition assembly and uncomfortable opposition governors. They sideline them. They don't want to get rid of anybody else, right? Because if they wanted to promote a sort of like a coup to keep just Maduro in power, they could have, you know, get rid of the attorney general after her statement on Friday.
Right. And actually that showed the fact that there was at least some splits inside the government. From your sense, how unified does the government seem to be? Obviously, it was Luisa Ortega Diaz who spoke out and said basically that I don't think this action is constitutional. Do you see very much unity, or do you think there's possibility of a lot of factions?
Well, I think the government, like any unit, any politician unit, right, any political unit, it's going to have divisions internally. However, I think so far the opposition has been so bad at identifying and exploiting this that the government has remained as one. Not until now is that we see the first major split. I mean, we've seen some split in the government. We saw some former Chavez ministers that have been very vocal and have joined sort of the leftist alternative, Maria Socialista, right, the socialist side. And And they were sort of they were vocal at the beginning after the assembly elections, and they were quickly shushed by the government, right? Now it's the first major. There's rumors about some sort of split with the military, but this is the first major vocal split, right? I think every other split so far has been more internal, and so this is the major, the first big major public split in the ruling coalition. And I think the opposition would be wise in trying to exploit this. They shouldn't force, they shouldn't push for too much, and they should provide some sort of backing for the attorney general and for others who may be thinking about splitting as well. But as I read somewhere, and this is probably true, it's, I think myself, is that I don't think the attorney general acted alone. There's some, I mean, she must, there must be other people with her that aren't out yet.
And it's interesting that you mentioned the opposition, because this was something I was thinking about even with Ecuador, is that it seems that for a lot of the right or center right, it's been extraordinarily difficult for them to articulate some kind of a message that could appeal to softliners or appeal even to voters. I mean, how likely is it that the Venezuelan opposition can actually effectively connect to softliners or encourage softliners?
This is a hypothetical, right?
Of course, it's hypothetical. Yes.
No, it's just that to be honest, I think usually this is the opposition has been very, very bad in taking government breakaways, right? Or in fostering the breakup of their governing coalition. In defense of the opposition, they've had a bad experience with Arias Cárdenas first and with Hermanes Carrà later, right? But the core of the opposition supporters are so politicized that they have a very hard time in opening up to anyone from the ruling coalition, right? You have to see the distrust in the so the radicals in the opposition for Henry Falcón, right? The governor of the state of Lara. And so they're very hard with that, and they've been difficult. I've said it all along. I've said it since 2015, and probably even before that, that the opposition needs to open a path for those who are within the regime, but see no way out and see their only option to survive within, or either the survival of the regime or that's it, right? That they don't see a way out with the opposition, and they need to open that, and they've been really bad at it.
Well, it's funny that you ask whether it's hypothetical. One of the things I actually, one of my goals with doing this podcast is to get political scientists to speculate a little bit. It's like we're afraid to. So like this isn't peer reviewed and it's not going to be judged, but sometimes I'll talk to people and they're like really nervous about, well, this is not what my research is on, or this is not what, because we're afraid to
No,
like
I mean,
speak out, and that's why Twitter's good. It's like it's fine to be wrong. It's okay.
technically they should be able to, right? Technically they
Sure.
have everything in their power to welcome disaffected Chavistas, right? And to encourage them to speak out. I mean, I think if the Luisa Ortega Diaz, it would have been, I think her breakup with the regime was at the right moment. I think this has been in the works. I don't know if with the opposition, I don't think so, but I think this has been at least in her mind in the works because she's been very quiet for the last year since the opposition won the National Assembly elections. So I wasn't surprised to see her statement. I mean, I was surprised in a way, oh my God, this is big. But at the same time, I wasn't surprised that it was her, the one who broke with the regime first. And I think the opposition should open, and I think they have the tools to open those doors, but they just haven't done it. A tweet that I read on the weekend was, "It doesn't matter at what time you read this, the opposition will screw it up." Right, and it was, I don't know if you read it. It was by one of the editors of Caracas Chronicle, the blog. And to be honest, that's kind of the feeling that that you have. In fact, I tweeted, and I think probably you tweeted, and so several people that I know tweeted something on the point of the opposition not screwing this up with Chavistas, right? With allowing them to jump off ship. And then I already got criticized, right? Somebody criticized, one of the warriors of the keyboards, right, as they call them, criticized me for that. So they have to appease people within the opposition and say, no, we need to open this for them to get out.
Yeah. Well, yes, I had a Twitter exchange with Kiko Toro of Caracas Chronicles where he was basically same thing. So it was funny though, cause then he said, oh, well maybe I'm wrong. And then a little while later, no, I'm right. So, but that's basically the debate is how much should the opposition reach out and how much is it even capable of reaching out? Switching a little bit, can you imagine a scenario under which the government allows the recall election to move forward?
I still think that's possible. In fact, I still think that's the smartest political move that the Chavismo could do if they still want to survive, right? They can compromise in sacrificing Maduro, in appointing a moderate vice president, and in holding the recall referendum, which of course they will lose.
Right.
The new moderate president would create a sort of a broad alliance government with people from the government and the opposition, and then they'll face off in 2018. I thought this should have been the case 5 years ago, or in 2013, sorry, when Maduro barely won the election. Mm-hmm. I still think this is the best case now. As I told a friend the other day, I don't think anybody's listening to what my ideal strategy for the survival. If Chavismo wanted to survive, it's like sometimes I wonder if they really want to survive this, right? It's like either we survive on board or we are going to die. And so that's why they don't want to get off.
Right. But one way or another, they're going to have to deal with presidential elections, and it's not very far away. So at a certain point, they have to decide how are they going to best put themselves in a position to win those elections.
Yeah, no, and I agree. Sometimes I feel like they're not thinking that through. I mean, they're just sort of they're not thinking that they'll have to do the elections in December of 2018, and it seems that they think they'll be able to postpone things. So it's, I wonder what goes in sometimes in the mind of the strategists within the government.
Yeah, or they're just somehow dealing with day-to-day crisis, and so they're not even
thinking
long-term.
I think that's probably it. I'm going to guess that's probably it. They're not thinking of the broader picture. To me, the broader picture is the survival of Chavismo as a political party. I mean, I think that would be my long picture. And it doesn't seem like that's what they're thinking. It seems like they're thinking, how can we guarantee that we get the most benefit at this point and stay in power, right? We don't want to relinquish power.
Right. Thinking about the international context, because of course we had the effort by Luis Almagro to have a vote that was basically censoring Venezuela and the OAS. What role do you think should other Latin American countries play, and what role will they likely play?
Well, I think other Latin American countries are the ones that have to lead the way. The problem that we have is that most of the leftist countries that could lead the way have changed to the right, right? So you have Argentina, you have Brazil, who are now governed by right-wing politicians, and so in the optics of things, it looks bad because it allows Maduro to say, "Oh, look, it's a right-wing conspiracy." Right? If the left were on board, and it seems like now with Friday's events or with last week's events, the Uruguay sort of finally decided, "No, we're on this." Right? And they stop with that wishy-washy position that they used to have before. So it now, with that, then Uruguay can take the lead so that it's not a right-wing group of governments that are leading the way against Venezuela. So in my views, it should be something like Uruguay and El Salvador, right?
Yep.
that lead the way, and Chile with Michelle Bachelet, right? If you have those three countries that are like, no, look, things are wrong in Venezuela. If PT finally came out and said, no, things are wrong in Venezuela, that would be a big problem for Maduro. In the weekend, I believe that Ecuador did not make any statements, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't remember any, yeah.
I don't remember any. I know Bolivia came out against the situation, I mean, criticized the opposition, and Nicaragua, I believe, did as well, but Ecuador sort of remained silent. And so that would have been an opportunity for Ecuador to also be like, okay, look, guys, that's wrong.
Right. And do you think how much is Maduro and other Chavistas, how much do they feel pressure from the international community, do you think? I mean, do they care? How much do they care?
I think they care to the point where they can sustain that they are a democracy,
Okay.
because that's always been the presentation card of the government, right? We're a democracy. Don't mess with us. We've been elected. We've been reelected. And so that's, I think they care a lot about that image. Then you have the problem of it seems like they have an internal problem of caring about the image as well. According to a report today, I don't know if it was on the Financial Times, on the Washington Post, a U.S. newspaper reported that the military actually pressured Maduro to retract the Supreme
Right.
Court
Yeah, I think
ruling.
it was the Wall Street Journal. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So and so there seems to be an internal concern about that as well, about that image. And so, well, there was some thought, I had the thought that the regime was going to just leave OAS after last week's rulings, when the OAS was discussing Venezuela, the Supreme Court came out with a ruling saying that the government should revise its membership into international organizations. And so that seemed to open the door for Maduro to leave OAS.
Yeah.
I think with the turn of events of this past weekend, that strong position sort of might have been affected.
Okay.
We'll see what happens because today OAS is discussing Venezuela again. So we'll see what happens today. But I think right now, the more democratic elements within the Chavismo might be pushing or might be threatening the government, right?
Right.
And that's an interesting dynamic that we had never seen.
That's right. And I actually wanted to follow up the question or the issue about the military. How much do you think is the military like the key to understanding what's going to happen in Venezuela?
Sadly, it seems that the military has the power to pressure the government, right? And I say sadly because it's very disappointing as a Democrat, right? Not Democrat in the U.S. Democrat sense,
Exactly,
but as
right.
a supporter of democracy and institutions and the rule of law. The military is not the guardian of democracy, right? In fact, if anything, the military is the institution that has been the worst enemy of democracy. And so it's in the Constitution, that nowhere does it give the military the role to defend the Constitution. Actually, that should have been the role of the Supreme Court.
Right.
And so it's very sad to see people in Venezuela, journalists and politicians themselves, right? The opposition called on the military
That's right.
to solve the situation. And to me, that's very sad because the military should not be called upon to interfere. And the fact that the military, according to the report that came out today, actually pressured the government, and a similar report also came out in 2015, where it said that the military had pressured the government to accept the results of the election, it's in a way sad because it showcases the extreme power that the military still has and still the big say that they have on politics, right? Thankfully, they seem to be siding with the side of democracy. But who is to say that tomorrow they won't?
Yeah, and I mean, over time, the government has put the military in increasingly into positions of power. Because wasn't it last year they put the military in charge of distributing food, and there were other things, so that the military itself, I'm sorry, the government itself is making the military even more important than it was before.
Correct. The government is giving the military a significant amount of power. And today they might think, look, it's in our best interest to stay in this position, that this regime remains a democratic crusade, right? Maybe in 2 years, 1 year, 6 months, who knows, they decide, well, you know what? We can't sustain this as democracy, but we can surely sustain it as a dictatorship, so let's go for that. So it's a significant problem that the military has so much power within the government, and that the opposition is asking for the military to intervene.
Yes, so and I think what we'll do, we're out of time, so we'll end with that on a sort of depressing note, but there's no good solution that I can really think of.
No, there is no good solution at this moment. And with the situation in Venezuela not being solved, I think we can't end on a happy note.
No, that's true. So I've been talking to Iñaki Sagarzazu, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Assistant professor of political science at Texas Tech University, and also find him on Twitter because he's another person who is active on Twitter. So, Iñaki, again, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.